Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.
An era of new challenges. Now the ones coming and taking over your land are saying that we need to save the planet. Interview with June Borras, one of the founders of La Via Campesina International. Saturnino June M. Borras Jr. is a Filipino political activist and academic who has been deeply involved in rural social movements in the Philippines and internationally since the early 1980s. He was part of the core organizing team that established the international peasant movement La Via Campesina. June has written extensively on land issues and agrarian movements. This is how the Transnational Institute of the Netherlands, TNI, introduces a Filipino activist who is a member of that organization and also of the International Institute of Social Studies based in The Hague, the Netherlands. He is also adjunct professor of the College of Humanities and Development Studies at China Agricultural University in Beijing. Real World Radio presents an interview carried out with June late last year after a conference on just energy transition organized by Environmental Rights Action, Friends of the Earth Nigeria, in the capital city of that country, Abuja. The current challenges in the struggle for land around the world, the new actors behind the grabbing of natural resources, the climate discourse as an excuse for looting, the rise of the fascist right wing, and the need for people's unity to face it are some of the issues addressed during the interview. We couldn't help as well to ask June to remember the moment when La Via Campesina was founded. Let's now listen to the interview.
During the last 2 days, presentations are very critically important in many respects. And I locate my own contribution in that wider, broader kind of discussion. My own take on that is that coming from a grand perspective is that the global food system of the capitalist order is one that is very much industrial, chemical-based, fossil-based, fossil energy-based, and fossil capital-driven global food system. And that global food system, in the very minimum, would contribute about 40% of the global emissions every year. There's no way to have a just energy transition without dismantling that global food system. And there's no way to dismantle that without, at the same time, offering an alternative system. And that is where the context of transition to agroecology kicks in, which means for the agrarian world, which is also very much the interest of the world more generally. A just energy transition should mean transition to agroecological way of production. But that, even that is a very, it's not the totality of agroecology, it's not the totality of global food system. It's one part, but a very important part. And it very much relates into the two out of the three spheres of the food regime. You have three spheres of production, circulation, and consumption. So at least agroecology would attack very much on the two spheres of production and circulation. Now, one of the most important requirements for transition to agroecology is the assumption that people should have and communities should have access to natural resources, land, water, forest, seas, that are very important ingredients for agroecology. But reality in the world today is that majority of the people who depend on the land and water and forestry for their livelihood don't have effective control over those resources. And those remaining on the land with access, their access is constantly threatened at the moment. So the point is that how can you transition to agroecology in this condition? That becomes a very daunting and challenging issue. The problem, if we don't locate the struggle for just energy transition in the context of transition to agroecology, in the context of a system-wide transition, the great danger is that the struggle for agroecology deteriorates into petty projects. Agroecological project here, agroecological project there, project here, projects there, and then scaling up is being interpreted of stitching together these different projects. But it doesn't, even individually and together, it doesn't make a dent in changing the broader structure, social structures, meaning it doesn't make system-wide transformation of the food system. So it becomes an urgent and necessary requirement to actually dismantle the existing property system that is very much under monopoly control of a few classes and elites. And that's land, water, forest. Now, that becomes a very complicated thing because during the past 10 years, especially with the convergence of multiple crises of food, energy, climate change, finance, and environmental crisis, one result of that is that everybody, including especially powerful classes and corporations, have become suddenly very interested to have control over these natural resources. Everyone now wants to have control of land, water, and forests for different reasons, including, you know, climate change mitigation, for carbon sequestration and offset arrangements. So they all wanted now suddenly forestry for different reasons. So democratizing land control in the past has always been very difficult. If we look at the struggles for land reform between the Mexican Revolution all the way up to the last of its kind in 1979 by the Sandinistas, it's always been very difficult. It's not easy. But it has become even more difficult, the question of democratizing land in the era of climate change.
That's a good point, because I was going to ask you that. So do you say it's even more difficult today? And how is it, especially in this context in which fascism seems to be winning some steps in different parts of the world?
Before, when you say land, especially land in the countryside, the only class enemy that you will identify are agribusiness corporations. The United Fruit, the corporation would get so much land in Ecuador, Honduras, in places. But these days, corporations who are interested in gaining a lot of land would be Daewoo car industry, Volkswagen, Volvo, all sorts of chemical companies, then including all sorts of new entrepreneurial entrepreneurs unleashed by the climate change discourse, who are into invention of carbon stocks and carbon trading. They're all interested in there. But there's also one that is emerging to be exponentially bigger and wider in terms of their scope of operation and power. One of the entities that have been very much empowered and emboldened in the era of climate change and climate change politics and discourse are the politically conservative big conservation organizations. In many places, the area that they enclose and take land away from villagers is hundreds of times bigger than combined all agribusiness corporations are land grabbing in those countries. One conservation project would be 1 million acres of land, for instance. It has become difficult because the number of powerful entities have multiplied. It's not just landed classes interested in agribusiness that are interested in farmlands or in forestry, but then you have many more who suddenly are interested there. And meanwhile, no one these days talks about redistribution of or restitution of land. So, when in fact, the more important points are redistribution of land in places where a lot of people don't have land and who wanted to farm, restitution of land in places where a lot of people were forcibly evicted for different reasons. Colombia has 7 million internally displaced people, IDPs. Burma, Myanmar has a million internally displaced people. Restitution is the only corrective policy framework for them. And then you have those who still have access, but their access is being constantly threatened. So most of indigenous people's communities is one. But the most vulnerable ones today are those people who are engaged more in less modern, mobile forms of agriculture, pastoralism, and artisanal fishing and forest dwelling. Because now suddenly you have these dual narratives being used against them and to justify enclosure of land and nature. The dual narratives is the narrative that these forms of production and ways of life are economically inefficient and ecologically destructive and should be stopped. Stopping means giving those lands and resources to corporations who would engage in monoculture. And we see that pattern worldwide as justification. So between the justification by agribusiness and central states of getting these lands from smallholders, mobile agriculture farmers, pastoralist artisanal fishing on the one hand, and the big claims of big politically conservative, big conservation organizations on the one hand. The actual result is everybody, all these elite entities get what they wanted to, and the poor are being eased out.
Okay, I get, and you made your points clear, June. So we have, for this energy transition that we were talking at the beginning, to have a just transition, then we need the development of the agroecology, this tremendous political flag of Via Campesina all around the world. But before that, we also need to get more access to our natural resources. So which would be, in your opinion, June, the ways for the peasant movements, peasant organizations, landless movements to move forward in a context which seems to be more and more difficult?
Well, two things. One is to converge. The other one is to think, to ask big. Okay, the first one, to converge. Well, there's a convergence of crisis and convergence of issues. That situation compels movements to converge in different ways, whether to converge to join forces or to start converging and fusing issues within their organizational campaign. For a very long time, most of these organizations were born on a sectoral kind of tradition. If you are an environmental advocacy movement, you are environmental agrarian, agrarian, food, food, and so on and so forth. But the current situation now renders that less effective. And the more effective way is to fuse them kind of together. So environmental movements should move more to understand and fuse and internalize some of the agrarian movements. How can you talk about just energy transition if you don't talk about global food system? But in the practical politics of daily operational campaigning, it's getting there. Via Campesina is also trying and improving, and Via Campesina members. But I think there's still a lot of room to improve and be more effective in that. Convergence of campaigns. That, I think, is one very important point. The other one is, it's not just an era marked by the rise of climate change politics, but it's also an era marked by the rise of far-right, the rise of right-wing groups. Many of them are authoritarian as well. But one lesson there is that this threat can be turned into something of an opportunity. The point is that people were just sick and tired of all the negative impacts of neoliberalism, and anything that is more, again, of more of the same of centrist politics that has defined many of the social democratic and centrist coalitional politics for the last two or three decades. People are just sick and tired of that. They are rejecting that. But the challenge, of course, is how the left and radical movements would be able to convert that into support to the left. Because so far, what is more successful is the right. Because the right started to ask big, meaning like, we want to dismantle this and so on and so forth. They were not at all conservative in terms of looking at big pictures close to the hearts of people. So I think for us, fundamental big questions would start with, like, if the problem is capitalism, then surely the positive future should not be found or cannot be found within capitalism. And if it's not capitalism, then what is it? On my own take, it should be a socialist positive future, but definitely should not be the way socialism is defined conventionally, but more in the generic way of a deeply democratic sense of distribution of wealth and power in societies. But how can we, in a socialist platform in which different strands of belief can be part of the dialogue, from communist parties, socialist parties, to degrowth, to anarchists, to feminists, should be able to have a safe and respected space, sit in that space for a dialogue.
And how do you see that, June, especially, you know, I come from Latin America, but I also know that you know quite well Latin American reality. So how do you imagine these new links between the social movements and the leftist parties that can at some point track these steps forward to gain again governments which are closer to the peoples?
Complicated thing, because there's a lot of open debates, the whole so-called pink tide phenomenon and the rise and the troubles of that current phenomenon as we speak. And each of the country experience also is very significantly different from another. And it's also risky to, sometimes it's easy for people from the outside who are not in the actual trenches of difficult, you know, seizing state power and transitioning to something new. It's easy to criticize. It's not easy to govern when you are there.
Absolutely, yeah.
I always kind of restrain myself from easy to say. But I think some points for discussion, like thinking big. The answer is more of further questions that we all should, not just the pink tide states in Latin America, but for that matter in many different countries worldwide, not just those who were able to seize political parties, who were able to seize state power, but including different left-wing political parties and social movements and intellectuals who were thinking about all these matters. One is probably a question of how were we able to take the correct reading of the pulse of ordinary people when some groups were in power. I think probably one legitimate question is that, was there some conservatism on the part of groups who gained power in terms of challenging and really recasting in a radical way the patterns of social relations and social structures, which means recasting the structures of power rather than just, not just because it's some of the gains were all really very significant and it's not peripheral, but you can distribute wealth. Not necessarily. This is the difference between distribution and redistribution. Distribution is a positive sum kind of gain, in which with the use of the state, you can give wealth and some power to some sectors of society without actually necessarily having other classes lose some. So it's a positive sum. Redistribution of wealth and power entails changing the relative shares of people. When some gain, others will have to lose. And I think there's one question about some of these things that, well, there's no denial that many have gained so much, but the structures of power were not significantly altered, and now they are coming back to basically undermine much of those political projects. So one is more of like probably bolder, and then I go back to the question of asking big and being, which really means being more daring to have a daring reading of the pulse of people. So something like there were already signals that people were being sick and tired of what they feel is more of the same, even when in form it comes in different forms, but they feel it's more of the same.
In this context in which fascism and agribusiness and big NGOs, as you were saying, and other elites are gaining control over territories, natural resources, land, as you said, the forest, water, etc. So do you see in the short term or in the midterm an arise in the fights to access to land, for example, that would be something that could impulse a new fight for the land with new actors?
It could be, and it should be. I think if it doesn't happen in the short term, my sense is that these new emerging actors who are actually getting into the natural resource thing would even get more entrenched, and therefore would even be very difficult to undo in the future. So actually, the challenge is how to do it big and how to do it now in terms of repositioning. But what is difficult is that many of those who are coming in the old days, when you say the big landlords, hacenderos, the big landlords, they are bad. You know, they get all the lands, they send all their kids to England to study or to Madrid, and then their peons and their campesinos are poor. It's very easy to justify on moral grounds that it's bad and it has to be. But now, the ones coming, taking over your land, is saying that we need to save the planet, so we need to enclose this 1 million hectares of land. It's not as straightforward to campaign in the same way in the old days. So that's my point of saying that it cannot be just the task of environmental movements like Friends of the Earth, or solely just the task of agrarian movements like Via Campesina. We need to join forces and to finesse and to really see the significant shift in terms of the nature and character of this shifting terrain and act accordingly. And then, again, ask big. My idea is that without the dual principles of minimum access to natural resources for those who would need it, minimum access. Everyone who would need land, water, forest should have minimum access. And then pair that with a ceiling. there has to be a cap to how much individuals and corporations can control. Without a minimum access and a ceiling, what that means is sky is the limit for those who can afford to accumulate. And the logic of capital is exactly that. And however beautiful is our framing of international treaties and principles and everything, it won't work without minimum access and cap. Is that impossible? No. Is that difficult? Yes. But what is comforting for us to remember is that many of the privileges and rights that we enjoy today look exactly the same thing before they happen. So 8 hours minimum work day. Before it happened, if you look back in history, it was like impossible to achieve that. Civil rights, women's voting rights. So many of our privileges and rights not nowadays we tend to take for granted. If we look back before they happened, when you look at there historically, it also looked impossible. But once you gain the political momentum there, it was not impossible. It reminds me of the debate between, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, Tolkien. Mm. There's a debate between the dwarf Balin and Gandalf. When Gandalf was trying to convince the dwarf, so they wanted to assault Smaug, the dragon, in the Lonely Mountain. But how to do it? Thorin, the leader of the dwarf, wanted to assault it with conventional warfare. And Gandalf said, no way. The only way to do it is by stealth. We have to recruit a hobbit, Bilbo, for that. Balin said, impossible. Gandalf said, no, absurdly difficult, but not impossible. And of course, in the end, Gandalf was right. And I think that's what it is too.
I can't avoid to ask you, Jung, with this framework, how impossible it looked to be the creation of a worldwide movement, a peasant movement, recognized by everybody in the fight for land.
1992. From 1990 to 1992, when we were in the process of organizing a possible, absurdly difficult, but not impossible, but definitely a big dream of having our own truly poor farmer peasant international movement. I was part of the organizing team, and we were going around, and we went to this one funding agency because we were trying to convince them to help fund our conference. And this I will not mention the funding agency in Europe, and the guy was very arrogantly saying that, oh, you have MST from Brazil and KMP in the Philippines, and then you recruit this very small European group, CPE, and then you call it now international movement. You are crazy. So, and of course, they didn't give us a single dollar at all. But that's what it is. People were just laughing at us. It's like crazy, crazy idea of having your own farmers movement. What they were trying to tell us is the practical way to do it is to join IFAP, the International Federation of Agricultural Producers. But the reason why we wanted to form what became La Villa Campesina is precisely because we already knew that from 1946 up to that time in the early 1990s, IFAP doesn't serve the interest of poor peasants. So we need to have our own movement. So people were laughing in the beginning. So from 1993 to 1996, people were still unconvinced that Villa Campesina would amount into something. During 1993 to 1996, when we were developing the notion of food sovereignty and we would be invited to give a talk and explain food sovereignty, even us would not be able to articulate what we mean by food sovereignty, and people even laugh at us. Like, what do you mean food sovereignty? It was painful. People were laughing. People were either skeptical, were laughing, or just didn't bother. Until, of course, that the moment came and something just clicked. And, of course, that's the historical moment was November 1996 in Rome, when suddenly the world was like, oh, well, we need to take this seriously. The rest, of course, is history. But before that, before 1993, that is impossible. That is an impossible dream to have a new international peasant platform and a new rallying kind of program, food sovereignty. But 25 years now, well, it was a very historic moment. It proved to be you were on the right side of history. The question, of course, is whether Villa Campesina would continue to be able to always be ahead of its time. It was ahead of its time in 1993 in terms of creative energy and seizing the moment. And it's always a challenge. It's part of the of movement building and movement maturation, of the ebbs and flows of that. And all movements go through that kind of dynamic. So it remains a challenge. Via Campesina is a great movement, doing a great thing, but movements don't flourish by just getting praised. Movements flourish by also getting praised and getting reminded of the pending tasks.
You also make me remember, June, once I heard a peasant from the MST saying, when the context is really difficult, we know that probably we have to go a step back, gain forces together again, having patience, and prepare the political arena to go forward again. So I guess this moment nowadays is a moment like that, how we unify again to advance.
Absolutely true. This is also the moment to kind of rethink the whole historical trajectory and your location in it. Institutionalization of movement cuts both ways. It's dangerously double-edged. It can make movements be complacent. Something like you become more comfortable to issues and issue framing and demand making and demands that you put that are all familiar to you. And sometimes it could lead to movements, and I'm not just referring to Via Campesina, it's movement more in general, to be complacent about things. Of course, in reality, great movements emerge from out of a kind of unrest, restive spirits, unrest, political unrest, in the sense that you are not completely contented in the way institutionalized movements are responding to the call of the times. So, and I think it's always the most difficult challenge in terms of what is to be institutionalized is less of the movement, but to institutionalize that political instinct among movement leaders and movement pillars to always be on the lookout in terms of that you continue to have a very close reading of the changing dynamics of the terrain on the one hand and the pulse of the popular social base that you are supposed to be swimming around. And it's not easy. It's easier said than done, but it's the most difficult thing. When we said in the late 80s and early 1990s that basta, this IPAP has to be put to its proper place and we need to have our own representation and voice in the international platform, and we need to start telling NGOs to stop going around and saying that they represent the peasants because we can represent our own. That was your needed kind of irreverence, movement irreverence, and something you challenge a convention. And I think that should always be part of the DNA of movements. So institutionalization should not be institutionalization of movements itself, because that could be very nature, but in institutionalization of very important political impulses and political instincts that make great movement.
Here we are. This is Real World Radio on air.